Support comes from Hampton Roads Community Foundation, partnering with donors from all walks of life to improve Southeastern Virginia through grants, scholarships, and leadership initiatives. Learn more at HamptonRoadsCF.org.
Hello, everyone. I'm Barbara Ham Lee. In 1870, the 15th Amendment to the Constitution outlawed racial discrimination in voting. But that didn't stop some states, particularly in the South, from doing everything from voter intimidation to poll taxes to literacy tests to keep blacks from voting. People were brutally beaten and even murdered over their right to vote. Nearly a century later, in August of 1965, the Voting Rights Act was signed into law. Over the years, the Supreme Court has chipped away at the power of the act, and it's happened again. What does all this mean for the rights of all Americans to vote? What's the impact on the African American community? Some answers when Another View returns right after this national, regional, and local news from NPR and WHRO News.
Discussing today's topics from an African-American perspective, this is Another View.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Another View. I'm Barbara Ham Lee. I was 8 years old when the Voting Rights Act became law in 1965. So I've had the privilege and responsibility to vote all of my life. But that was not the case for my parents, grandparents, and other loved ones who lived through the Jim Crow era of poll taxes, literacy tests, and intimidation when they went to the polls. Now some folks in the black community are wondering if we're going back to those bad old days in light of the latest decision of the Supreme Court that ruled that it is unconstitutional for states to draw congressional maps based on race. What does all of this mean? Here to unpack it for us is Dr. Vania Blakelock. She is a constitutional law scholar and holds both a JD and a PhD from the College of William & Mary. How are you, Dr. Blakelock?
I'm great. Thank you for having me today, Barbara.
Thank you so much for being with me. And we are also honored to have joining us by phone Congressman Cleo Fields, who serves the 6th Congressional District in Louisiana. How are you, Congressman Fields?
I am doing great, Ms. Barbara, and it's good to be with you.
Thank you. It is so good to have you with us. So it is your state and Louisiana versus Callis that has stirred up all this stuff. I'm wondering what you're hearing from your constituents and how you are feeling as a congressman representing the 6th District right now.
Well, actually, you know, I've been moving around the district. I started Monday in Shreveport and then on Tuesday and Alexandria, Lafayette last night, and tonight I'm in Baton Rouge. The people are very upset. I mean, people feel that their voting rights are being trampled on. They do not agree with the Supreme Court decision. But people in Louisiana, we've been down this road before. This same case came before the Supreme Court 2 years ago, and they knocked it down. This is the same state where, Plessy v. Ferguson, where the Supreme Court ruled that it was totally legal to be separate. They legalized segregation. But people kept fighting, and they kept marching, they kept protesting, and things changed. We knocked down Plessy v. Ferguson. The Voting Rights Act, we used to rely on subsection 5, which gave states like Louisiana the obligation, had, put them under the obligation of the federal law, where they had to go to Washington to get any kind of law that impeded upon a person's right to vote. It had to be pre-cleared by the Justice Department. We don't have that luxury anymore.
That was taken away in 2013.
Shelby County.
Yeah.
Beholder.
Yep. Right.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm. And so we today we were just relying on that subsection 2, and thus the Supreme Court ruled on Wednesday, that really doesn't have any effect anymore. They changed the whole test. It used to be a fact. Now they're saying that you got to prove intent. And so we need a new Voting Rights Act. And it's unfortunate. And I'm happy to serve in Congress. And I say it all the time with members of the Congressional Black Caucus who are elected not from majority black districts, but they're elected from majority white districts. And that's a great thing. But people from Mississippi and Louisiana and Alabama, you know, these big, these southern, deep southern states, they don't have that luxury.
Yeah.
You know, in Louisiana, we've never elected a black person to Congress in a majority white district. Many have run, but none have ever been elected. Yeah, same thing with Mississippi and Alabama. But you know, we're going to fight it, and this is just another, you know, hurdle they've put in our way.
What do you say to people that say we're going back to Jim Crow because it's the majority southern states where this is really where the redrawing and everything is really happening, different from Virginia, where at least the voters were able to vote on an amendment to make change. And what's happening in your state and other southern states is that legislators are making that decision.
Yeah, and it actually comes from the top. I mean, the president of the United States, the first executive order he signed, you know, when he took office, he said, I'm going to do away with diversity, equity, and inclusion, and bragged about it, you know, and then threatened colleges and universities. If you have any type of diversity program, we're going to take away your federal funding. bragged about it with hospitals across America, threatening them to take away their funding. And so people, diversity, equity, and inclusion on his watch became a bad thing, and people started backing up. And so it's like a whistle call to the nation, you know, we don't need diversity. And I beg to differ with the president. You know, when our military didn't have African Americans, didn't have women, you know, when it wasn't diverse, it was not as great as it is now. When it became diverse, it became the most fierce fighting machine in the world. And no one can second guess that. Diversity is a good thing, not a bad thing. But when you have a president, you know, who picks up the phone and called the governor of Texas and said, I need five more Republican seats. And then the governor of Texas just said, okay, and then he just go and do it. You know, that's just bad for America.
So what can voters do? You know, how can we help to make change?
I think voters can do the same thing John Lewis did, the same thing Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks. They need to be involved in the process. I was at a town hall, and one of the voters said in Shreveport, well, you know, I don't feel like my vote values, and I'm just not going to vote anymore. And my response to her was, well, tell me how that works. So how, you know, you're going to now just let them do what they want to do? And then she changed her view and her opinion. We need to get more involved in this process.
Yeah. I'm wondering, Congressman. I'm sorry. Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Yeah. Basically, every citizen across America should register to vote. And they should get people, all the people similarly situated around them, registered. And they should go to the polls and they should vote. You know, southern states are under attack. And it's not just Congress. Tomorrow is going to be state legislatures, and then school boards, and then city councils, and judges. And we need people now to just stand ready and go and vote. And then what Congress can do, the next Congress, they can pass a John Lewis Voting Rights Act and recognize there are southern states in this country that still have not gotten beyond block voting. And vote for people based on the color of their skin versus the content of their character.
There are young people out there today who did not experience the marching and or may not even have parents who experienced it. And so they haven't passed down that legacy. How do you talk to them? How do you keep them engaged because they say the days of marching are over. We're done with that. We, you know, then tell them what else to do.
Well, I mean, the same way my sister, my oldest sister, connected to with me. You know, when I had the questions, you know, when I was, 10 years of age, when I presented her the question of, you know, why we need a Voting Rights Act. We got a 15th Amendment and we got a 19th Amendment. And people need to be mindful of the fact that was a time when if you were a black male in this country, you were not only white people, white males voted. That was a privilege for them. And it wasn't until the passage of the 15th Amendment, black males got the right to vote. But women still didn't have the right. Mm-hmm. Women didn't get it until the 19th Amendment. Mm-hmm. And people, when you tell them that, they say, what? Yeah, you know, that's why that right is so precious. And that's why people need to get up and go out and use it. I think I'd do the same thing I did same thing my sister did with me. When I questioned her about why we got to have a Voting Rights Act, you know, don't people have the right to vote? And she explained, you know, even after people got the right to vote, you know, there were towns and cities in the southern part of our country that said, okay, you got the right to vote, but you got to first register. You got to first come through me. And then they brought, you know, that's where the Jim Crow laws came from. You know, they had prerequisites to even register to vote. You know, old ladies would show up to go register to vote, and the register would say, you know, tell me how many jelly beans are in a jelly bean jar. You know, how many bubbles are in a bar. So state the preamble to the Constitution. Then they got even more sophisticated. They had poll taxes.
Yeah.
You know, you got to own property in order to register to vote. And that should motivate young people, you know?
Exactly.
There's nothing magical about it other than just giving them the history. We weren't born with the right to vote, you know?
I was going to say, giving them the history, that is one of the key things that we need to keep talking about and keep explaining to people so that they can understand the impact going forward. We're going to keep our eye, we know you've got to run, but we're going to keep our eye on what's happening there in Louisiana. And if you would love to come back, we'd love to have you to as things progress so that we can keep up with going on. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, Ms. Barbara.
All right. All right, take care. All right. That is Congressman Cleo Fields. Well, he is with the 6th Congressional District in Louisiana. We appreciate that. Vania, excuse me. I knew I was going to do that.
No worries.
So I have an email from a viewer, a listener of Another View, who wrote me last week, and she said, and I quote, in light of the Supreme Court decision, we need to make sure no state draws voting districts to benefit white voters or on the basis of white race. Hmm. In other words, we need states to clarify exactly what criteria states are using in drawing districts and how heavily they are weighting each of those various criteria. Too often, when the powers that be say race has no place in these kinds of decisions, what they mean is white people get to make decisions to benefit white people. And she wrote me back to say, that not that it's relevant, she said, but I'm white and I'm deeply concerned about the persistence of racism and the continuing multi-generational effects of slavery, Jim Crow, redlining, disparities in investment, public education, healthcare, etc.
Yeah.
So that allied. So there are other people out there who also want to fight this fight with the marginalized communities.
Yeah, and I think it's important to note that this doesn't just affect minority voters. I mean, it affects minority voters directly, but as I was kind of explaining before we got on the air, one of the more important things is that the Supreme Court has kind of given a rubber stamp to partisan gerrymandering. And so we all know that for the most part, Black Americans, not all of them, we're not a monolith, but for the most part, vote as Democrats. Mm-hmm. And so what the Supreme Court has said is, that can't be evidence of voting bloc cohesion. We're no longer going to say because the state has 8 Republican districts and 1 Democratic district that Black Americans voting is diluted. And so on the one hand, like, that makes sense. But on the other hand, what that has done is that it has immediately opened the door for all states to have to battle one another. Even Democratic states who have historically passed laws and constitutional amendments to have bipartisan commissions draw their lines.
Like Virginia.
Like Virginia. Mm-hmm. They are going back on that. And so we're in this kind of national partisan war that is just going to make polarized politics even worse.
So in Louisiana, and I should have asked the congressman about this, but the fact that the governor has now halted the congressional race, the primaries, which were supposed to take place May 14th, I think it was. Or 16th.
May 2nd.
Okay. So he's paused that, but says the rest of the issues that were on the ballot can still continue.
Yeah.
And then you've got this substantial group of people who have already voted. And their votes for their choice for Congress people is out.
Yeah. Yeah.
How is that legal?
So he declared a state of emergency, which is the only real way to stop an election. And because the official primary wasn't until May 2nd, mm-hmm. he could do that. However, this is actually interesting for the Virginia case because one of the arguments that Republicans are making is that our process was incorrect because elections had already started. And so what's interesting is what happens in Louisiana actually might have some impact on how the Supreme Court thinks about this, because if it's good for Louisiana, it should be good for us, right?
So is that, you think that's part of the reason why it's taken so long for the Virginia Supreme Court to make a decision?
No. I think they are really wrestling with the kind of procedural approach that the Democrats took to get this amendment to the forefront. I don't want to make any predictions about how they're going to decide, of course. But I will say that however they decide, it is unlikely that this could be appealed to the federal Supreme Court, or that Republicans would want it appealed to the federal Supreme Court, because the Supreme Court has said partisan gerrymandering is fine, and that it's not. In 2019, in Rucho v. Common Cause, they say we can't even deal with that. That's a political question. It's not a jurisdictional question. That being said, what we did in Virginia was partisan. It was partisan. We all know that it was partisan. It's the Democrats. They're explicit about it, right?
Like, right.
All the advertisement is we're countering what happened in Texas.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
So it would be unlikely, I think, for the court to step into Virginia's election that way.
Where do you think people's heads are around this whole thing? I mean, I tell you, honestly, when I first started, after the ruling came down and I started reading, you know, to try to understand what's going on, it's not easy.
No.
To understand what exactly is happening. So if you had to break it down to a 30-second elevator speech, but you can take 3 minutes, what would explain to people exactly what this is saying in terms of their rights going forward in terms of voting?
So I think what's important is that to understand what happened in April 2026 in the Supreme Court, you kind of have to understand what happened in 2013, and then you kind of have to understand what happened in 1965. So just to give a little bit of history of the Voting Rights Act, we have the Reconstruction Amendments, 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, that expand citizenship to the formerly enslaved. The 15th Amendment specifically says that Congress or states cannot abridge voting on race, color, or prior condition of servitude. That happens, and in the early for a while in Reconstruction, you have increased Black men voting. You know, you have Black men in states' legislatures. You have Black men in the U.S. Congress, in the Senate. And very quickly, when Southern Democrats get back into power, because at that time the Democrats were the conservative party, they immediately start to create laws mm-hmm. to get around that. And I would like to point out that often it was not explicitly the intent wasn't explicitly about race, right? Mm-hmm. You had literacy tests. It wasn't that Black people had to have literacy tests. Everyone had to have literacy tests to vote. Poll taxes. It's just how they were executed were different, whether you were Black or white. They would create their grandfather clauses. You know, they would say, they would make laws that say, not that Black people had to fall into the grandfather clause. They would say, if your grandparent could vote in 1850, you can vote. On its face, that's a neutral law.
Yeah.
But you have to understand that that's not a neutral law. Like, that targets Black Americans. And so what this court is doing is kind of pushing us back to that same kind of understanding of how the law works. And what we know is that the law is never neutral.
Why is this? Because I've always wanted to ask somebody this question. Why is it an act that has to be reaffirmed ever so often, as opposed to a law that is done?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the 15th Amendment and the 13th and the 14th Amendment, they have provisions that allow Congress to enforce these amendments. And because they're doing things that were traditionally not allowed. So before the 15th Amendment, states had free rein in designing elections. They could do whatever they want. They could contingent voting on property ownership, on being a white male. That's generally was the rule. And so the 15th Amendment creates a hurdle that wasn't otherwise there. And so to do that, they had to give Congress the authority to step in.
Okay.
The Voting Rights Act is a part of congressional authority to enforce the 15th Amendment. And so they have to they reevaluate it every few years. The 1980 amendments actually were responding to something the court did. So the court was faced with the question of, if a state drew lines where they were diluting minority voting, not explicitly restricting how Black votes, but basically making it so that you could vote, but your vote wouldn't have any real political power. Mm-hmm. And that court says, you know, in the 1980s, they say, this is only about intent. Section 2 is only about intent. And Congress says, no. In 1982, they actually amend Section 2, which is the section at issue here, to say, no, effect can count. The effect, the racial effect can matter. And just for so your listeners know, one of the main attorneys who was fighting this amendment, who was lobbying Congress to not push this amendment to the Voting Rights Act through, was none other than Chief Justice Roberts. So this has been a long, long process, right? From the beginning of fighting, trying to resist the Voting Rights Act. And he, you know, wrote Shelby County, which got rid of Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act in 2013.
And remind people what Section 5 was.
Yes. Okay. So Section 5 is, and I meant to do this earlier, I explained the two sections, but Section 5 was the preclearance requirement. So in some ways, Section 5 was much more transformative than any other part of the Voting Rights Act, because it's the only area of our law where the federal government was preventative. So it was preventing racial discrimination before it even happened. So if a state wanted to change a voting right rule, voter ID laws, things like that, and they were in the South, they had to send that whatever they were trying to change to the Attorney General, or either to a federal court in the District of D.C., and they had to approve it and get permission for it. And you will notice after 2013, we see all of these states start to create voting ID laws and other restrictions on voting that they wouldn't have otherwise have passed as quickly. And what's interesting about Shelby County is that Justice Roberts, he writes the opinion, and he is very intentional to say, oh, but you still have Section 2. So don't worry, right? This is not as alarming as people are making it seem, because you still have Section 2. You can still remedy discrimination.
And Section 2 was supposed to say, was then to say, you could not, you had to make sure that you had majority.
Not that you had to have majority-minority districts, but Section 2 is more of kind of a remedy after the fact. So if states are drawing maps and a plaintiff says, hey, actually this map is diluting the minority vote for whatever reason, they could bring that to the court. And the court had a standard of how you prove that. And the way that you would prove it is by showing maps that could alternatively be drawn where majority-minority districts could have more of a voice, by showing that this is called the Gingles test. It comes from another Supreme Court decision. By showing that the minority group voted as a block, and by showing that the majority group consistently voted in a way that prevented the minority group from getting their electoral choice heard. And then lastly, they would look at the totality of the circumstances and basically say, like, do we think this has a racially discriminatory effect? And that's how a plaintiff would question a map. what they do in Louisiana v. Kalis is that they change that test. First, they say you can't just bring an alternative map anymore. The plaintiff's alternative map has to account for the political ends of the state legislature. So you would have to draw a map that gives majority, minority, I'm going to just use Black Americans as an example, but that would give Black Americans a larger voice, but that also considers the state's desire to preserve incumbency, because that's what happens in Louisiana, right? Like, they draw this map because they want to provide, because
they want the same people to stay in office,
right? Particularly Mike Johnson, the Speaker of the House. That's the first big thing. And then they say, for the totality of the circumstances, and I think this is important, they say you no longer can show effect. That doesn't matter. You have to show that legislatures intentionally are considering race when they're drawing these maps. And we know that that just doesn't happen anymore. People are not explicit about the fact that no one thinks they're racist, right? Like, we live in a post-racial society, right?
Yeah, sure.
So it's incredible. So this is what people mean when they say it obliterates Section 2, because essentially it's made it harder for plaintiffs to prove a case of discrimination under Section 2. And also that it has approved partisan gerrymandering. It's a disentangled party from race. So,
and that's hard to do if you have a group of people who normally vote,
right,
or the majority vote in within a certain party.
Yeah.
So to try to disentangle that.
And I'd like to point out that in 2024, there was a very similar case, Alexander v. South Carolina State Conference of the NAACP, which was the reverse, right? This was the NAACP challenging South Carolina's map. Mm-hmm. And in that case, the court is again saying, we're going to presume that the legislator is acting under partisan grounds, not racial grounds, without ever once acknowledging that those two things are one and the same.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the Voting Rights Act and the impact of the latest Supreme Court ruling that says states cannot draw congressional maps based on race. Our guest is Dr. Vania Blakelock. She is a constitutional law scholar and holds both a JD and PhD from the College of William & Mary. 757-440-2665 or 1-800-940-2240 are the numbers to call to join our conversation. What questions do you have about what is going on, and are you concerned about how your vote will count going forward? 757-440-2665 or 1-800-940-2240. So there's been, you know, the civil rights groups have been screaming. There's been a lot of, you know, discussion among African Americans in particular about what this ruling means and so forth. But I want to read a couple of quotes from Project 21, which is, as a matter of fact, I will read how they describe themselves, because I don't want to put words in people's mouths. Project 21 is a leading voice of Black conservatives for over 30 years. It's sponsored by the National Center for Public Policy Research, and they sent out an email with several quotes that responding to the Supreme Court's decision. This one particular one: today is a great day for Americans who choose to live their lives as one nation under God. For those who have built their golden calf and altar around race and divisiveness, not so much, says Project 21 Director of Coalitions and Outreach, Terrace Todd. Today's America would be unrecognizable to a generation that lived 100 years ago. However, it appears some people still seek to hold on to grievances, even though they are far removed from them. For instance, even in a city like Detroit, Michigan, which is about 80% Black, has chosen a white mayor to represent them for years, and today has no Black representation in Congress. Another one was: the Supreme Court decision on redistricting Louisiana is fair and just, said Project 21 Ambassador Kendall Qualls. The United States of America is not stuck in a racially divided 1960, despite what academia and the mainstream media say. My parents lived through the segregated Jim Crow South. They would have loved to have grown up in the America I grew up in. Those are just two members of Project 21, which are African-American conservatives. So number one, it goes to show that we are not a monolith and people think differently. But I'm wondering, it's particularly about this idea of academia and mainstream media presenting things as if we're stuck in 1960. Is that accurate, do you think?
No, I mean, I think most people, even someone like Derek Black, right, the founder of kind of critical race theory, acknowledged that we've made progress. The fact that I, a Black woman, could go to William & Mary and get my, you know, PhD and JD, like, that is progress.
The fact that we're on the radio talking
exactly,
about this is progress.
That's progress. but at the same time, it is progress that is, we've always known was fragilely held. And so the idea that because, I mean, there's a very famous quote, Justice Ginsburg in the dissent in Holder in 2013 says, what the court is saying is that just because you're outside when it's raining and you're holding an umbrella, that we should get rid of the umbrella. And that's kind of the approach. What I would say is for what the conservative Black Americans in those quotes are hinting at is this idea of colorblind constitutionalism. And I want to stress it because a lot of times the Supreme Court, especially the conservative majority, will articulate colorblind constitutionalism as if it has always been the law, if it's always how we've read the Constitution.
You know, it's interesting that you bring that up because there's one other one that says, today the court recognized that our Constitution is colorblind when it comes to racial gerrymandering, and all state legislators must adhere to this. I commend the Supreme Court as it continues to uphold this vital colorblind policy, a policy that ensures no American is favored over another because of his or her race. To quote Justice Thomas, today's decision should largely put an end to this disastrous misadventure in voting rights jurisprudence. We at Project 21 continue to strive to make sure that all Americans, white, Black, or brown, live in an America that sees them as individuals and not as race-hued beings separated into groups.
Yeah.
I'm going to talk to Pam in Yorktown. Hi, Pam. You're on the air.
Hi there. I am a Caucasian female, 76 years old, and a political activist since the 1960s, so I'm getting tired of it. I have always, I'm a libtard by today's definition. I have always fought for those without voices. And what disturbs me is the lack of participation by too many minorities. They just don't get involved. And sometimes it's because of their age, the ignorance of what the past was about. They don't feel that it affects them. And therefore, why should they worry about it? And it does. Everything that was given to us, if that's even a term we fought for is a better term, is going away right now. Our democracy is not here. It's dead. And if we want to revive it, we have to get to the polls. It will make a difference. If you get out and you protest, it will make a difference. You may not see it today or tomorrow, but it does help. I mean, I've lived through where I was married and pregnant and fired from a job for being pregnant. I lost a job simply because the owner of the company I work for tried to rape me, and I pushed him off and said, I don't care for causing my job. Get the hell away from me. And the next day I was fired. That wasn't illegal. You couldn't get contraception, not even a condom, in Massachusetts when I was growing up. The things we have all faced, whether it was voting. Now, I was never held back at the polls. But had I been a bit older, I wouldn't have been able to vote.
Yeah, I hear you, Pam. And I want to give our guest time to respond. We really appreciate the phone call. But she brings up a very good point. There are a lot of areas where people across the board have been affected, you know, by not having laws that were protective.
Yeah, no. And on the voting piece, you know, I am younger. And I do realize that there is a generation of people my age and younger who feel as if voting doesn't matter. And you have to understand, right? Like, I am the 9/11 generation. From the time I could think, we have been in situations that suggest that the government just operates the way that it wants to operate. And I do try to push back and tell my friends, you know, elections matter. This is anecdotal, but the only reason we have Brown v. Board of Education is because Justice Vinson has a heart attack, right? And we just happen to have a president that appointed Chief Justice Earl Warren. If another person was appointed, that decision is very different. Elections matter. We have Trump has appointed 3 Supreme Court justices. Had he not won in 2016, our world would look very different. And so I think the key is to show young people that harm reduction still is a value. We can still work towards revamping the entire system. No one believes that the system that we have right now is perfect. I don't think anybody, young or old, but harm reduction still also matters. And so that's at least the way that I've been trying to convince people my age to care about getting out and voting, even if you think it's lesser of two evils,
absolutely,
right?
You were telling me about your background, yeah, and I would love for you to share, because I think it really goes to the point of, one, again, we're not a monolith, and two, that people, if you take the time to study and understand what's happening in your world, it makes a difference from in terms of your perspective, and perspectives change, yeah, as you grow.
Yeah, so I grew up in a really, really conservative environment. I went to private Christian school all the way up until law school. Even my undergrad was a private Christian university. My friends' parents, all Republicans. I have an uncle who's a Republican. He's not MAGA, he would want me to say, but he is a Republican. And so I have been very sympathetic to the kind of Black conservative ideas, the idea of small government, the ideas of kind of the don't tread on me, the government not being involved in intimate decisions. And going into law school, I would have said that I would never have called myself a Republican, but I was pretty conservative, mm-hmm, by any mark of today's definition, for sure. Free markets, capitalism. And what happened is, in law school, I was really interested in the Constitution. I've been obsessed with the founders since I was a kid. And in constitutional law, it actually was when we were doing Brown and learning a lot about Brown. We watched Eyes on the Prize in my con law class. Mm-hmm. And just really getting in that history and realizing that just because something is legal doesn't make it just. And that just because something just because the law is a certain way right now, it doesn't mean it has always been that way, really restructured how I thought about rights, how I thought about citizenship, how I thought about America. And I genuinely believe that America can be inclusive. It can be the democracy that we want it to be. In fact, in my dissertation, one of the things that I argue is that Black Americans have been the architects of forcing American ideals to be reality. And I think the Voting Rights Act is one of those examples of forcing this idea of all men being created equal, man, women, trans, non-binary, everyone being created equal, forcing that to be true when it comes, mm-hmm, to political involvement. Mm-hmm. But for it to be true, we're going to have to fight. They're not going to give it to us. The people in power aren't going to give it to us, right?
757-440-2665 or 1-800-940-2240. Sean Paul joins us from Norfolk. Hi, Sean Paul. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Yeah, I just wanted to add to the part of how we need to get out there and vote, kind of, is one of the strategies that we're always told to utilize, while at the same time, it doesn't always work. And it seems like, you know, understanding like Schneider and Ingram, that when people are put into certain social locations and framed as things as deviants or other things, that then they don't have the access or the ability or desire to engage in a system that doesn't even recognize them. And that's kind of where it seems that, and understanding that this is a system that continues to marginalize. So if the system is inherently flawed, then that's where the rights and understanding that how rules frame how we understand our perceptions of constitutionality. And coming back to what the other doctor said, that as a PhD student in public policy, it's one of those things that if we are able to communicate our experience and understand what is actually going on, then we're able to come to better policy that actually works in everybody's favor. But it's never been allowed for everyone to have a voice at the table, which is why violence has perpetually, or revolution, right, has perpetually happened, depending on how you have to frame that.
Got you. Thank you so much, Sean Paul, for the call. We appreciate that. You want to respond?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's a really, really important perspective, and also how most people feel. I mean, I think even if you were someone who fought during the civil rights movement and still alive, because it wasn't that long ago, despite what the majority wants us to believe, it would be disheartening, I think, to think that we could make progress. The circumstances that allowed for Brown, that allowed for the Voting Rights Act, that produced a Martin Luther King, that produced a Malcolm X, those were really unique circumstances. I mean, you had the Cold War happening. You had, you know, women entering the workforce. Like, there was a lot of things happening that maybe are not the same now. Earlier, you asked the congressman when people think that we're going back to a Jim Crow era, how would he mm-hmm. respond to that? And I was thinking that in some ways, what we are approaching might be even harder to dismantle than Jim Crow because it's not explicit. Because wow. we've said now that it's neutral. Like, it's so much easier to fight racism when someone is calling you
the N-word,
yeah. right? Mm-hmm. It's much harder to fight racism when someone is saying, you know, I'm not discriminating on you against you because you're Black. I'm discriminating against you because you're a Democrat. Like, that's much harder to deal with. And so I think our strategies have to be different.
So we've got to learn how to change those strategies. Yeah. Explain to people why it matters to have first of all, before I even go there, this change and the way that these states are redrawing maps and so forth now, it doesn't just affect Congress.
Right. So most people are focused on the national elections right now because that's where all the action is happening, especially in light of the midterms. But it's not just Congress. It could be in the ways that, you know, we elect any federal office, state offices, localities. Most people don't realize that during Jim Crow, it wasn't just that they were prevented from being in Congress. They couldn't serve as
mayor.
Yes, exactly. They couldn't serve as on the city council.
Right.
Like, those are people who actually are involved with your day-to-day life, making decisions that affect your school board. Those kinds of elections can be shaped by this amendment. Sorry. Did you have
another? Yeah. And well, the other thing I was going to ask was about the fact that why is representation mm-hmm. in Congress or on the school board or on city council, for that matter, why is that so important? Because, you know, according to Project 21, you know, with Detroit, you know, they haven't had a Black representation in Congress. Does that mean they're not getting what they need?
Yeah.
Who knows?
Okay, so first of all, that's a straw man argument. And I think one of the things that people misconstrue when they hear you're using race to draw lines is that they think that that means quotas.
Right.
And it's never meant quotas. It's why Black, and honestly, Black Americans don't vote that way. And if you look at the Virginia governorship, right, people were very surprised that Governor Spanberger got a significant chunk of the Black vote. And so I think, one, it's kind of actually dismissive to suggest that Black Americans only care about voting for Black people. Mm-hmm. That's not what the Voting Rights Act says. It's the political power to vote for the candidate that addresses your needs the most. That might be a Black person. It might not be. It might be a Democrat. It might not be, right? If we're talking early 20th century, It's not.
It's kind of like when I was news director, one of the things that was very important, I always felt that the newsroom should be representative of the community it serves.
Yeah.
Same thing in Congress, same thing in city council. Because if you have that representation, then you have a multitude of ideas and thoughts, and you can serve everyone.
Yeah, there's this concept in history and in the law, and that the founders always engage with, this notion of tyranny of the majority, right? We want to protect, the fear about democracy is that the majority will be able to oppress the minority and there will be nothing that they can do about it. And so say you have a district of six districts and you have a population of 10 black people and a population of 50 white people. Technically speaking, you could let all those black people vote if they were in one of them were in each district, right? You know, and they could vote, but they would never be able to have the same kind of political power that the majority culture has. Now, what you could do instead, which is what we have done since the Voting Rights Act, is you could say, okay, we'll draw the lines so that those 10 black people are in one district, the 50 white people are in the four other districts. They still get 4-5 of the representatives, by the way, and you have that one. So at least you have one. At least you have someone in the room who can consider your perspective.
And even out of that district, it may not be a black person.
It may not be a black person. and I think what's important, too, is that these are not just the rules that were required to prove these majority-minority districts and to design these majority-minority districts. It's not like you just have dots of blue people. They still had to be congruent. They still had to comply with standard redistricting rules where they touch one another and they're a certain shape, right? You couldn't just say like Chesapeake and Arlington are going to be a majority minority district, right? Yeah, but if you're not local, that might not make sense to you. But
they're both in Virginia. One's in Northern Virginia. One's in Hampton Roads.
Exactly. They still have to be cohesive. So it's not just the Wild Wild West. In fact, now it is the Wild Wild West because partisans can.
So where do you think we're going to go from here?
Oh, that's a great question. I think the 2028 election and the 2026 midterms are going to be rough. It is unclear what that's going to look like. I mean, the day the Louisiana decision was decided, Southern states begin trying to redraw their lines. Mm-hmm. Some of them are restricted by law to wait to the 2028 election so that it's not for midterms, but some of them are not. Both Florida and Virginia have passed these amendments, but they're under contested. We don't know what the court's going to say. And I think that we're just going to be in a period of chaos for a little bit when it comes to elections. And unfortunately, that doesn't do anything to strengthen the already belief that our elections are not fair, that they're not ethical, that they're not just. And so to rebuild that, it's going to take a lot of work.
I was going to say, do you think that it can be rebuilt?
I'm an optimist. A lot of my friends and colleagues think I'm naive. But I will say that I read a lot of the conventions of Black Americans right after Reconstruction. And I always tell people that's where I find hope, is that a people who had been enslaved for hundreds of years truly believed in the American experiment and worked really hard to make those dreams a reality. And if they can do that, we certainly can work to do that.
Last question, and we're about 4 minutes before it's done. I told you we'd go by fast. In Virginia, the citizens voted to make a change. In California, the citizens voted to make a change. In Louisiana and in Tennessee,
in Texas and Florida,
it is the legislators. It's the people who are already in power. Does it matter? Does it make a difference in terms of the fairness, I guess?
I think, the kind of gut reaction is that it does make a difference. Some might argue that it doesn't, because even the state legislatures are representative of they're the representatives of the people, so it's the same action. And I do think that they're one of the dangers of, and the courts kind of force this to be true, is that states have to fight fire with fire. And so you have states that have, like New York and Colorado, who have historically had bipartisan commissions draw their lines, and now they're trying to undo that, not because they're trying to get a Democratic advantage. I mean, they are, but because they have to deal with the kind of gamesmanship that is happening in other states.
And that's really where the issue came, because had the president not called for those five seats,
right,
perhaps none of this would be happening.
And I would say, like, one of the big answers, and I'm not trying to be dismissive, is that people actually do have to vote. Because the thing about gerrymandering is it's just predictions, right? There's a world in which you could gerrymander yourself out of office. This is happening in Texas. They're very suspicious that some of their line drawing is actually going to gain Democrat seats than lose them. And so people just need to vote. And
that it really is where the power comes
yep.
in, isn't it?
Yep.
You know, they have got to get
if
out
voting
and vote.
Didn't matter, they wouldn't work this hard for decades to keep us out of it.
Yeah. So it really does matter. You know, you give me hope to see a young person. No, seriously, because I know that life right now is a lot about day to day. You know, people worried about the gas prices and food and, you know, and it's like, okay, whatever y'all are doing up there, you know, fine. But we've got to be able to pay attention.
Yeah, for sure.
For sure. Absolutely.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, absolutely. And congratulations on obtaining your PhD.
Thank you.
And all the new changes that are happening in your life. That is fantastic. Thank you so very much. That is Dr. Oh, I love this. So Dr. Vania Blakelock Esquire.
Yes.
That is fantastic. So I want to talk with you all about a couple of things that are happening in the community that are really important that I think you want to know about. And starting with this coming Saturday, there's a huge community day on Saturday, May the 9th from 12 until 5 at the Campostella Shopping Center in Chesapeake. And all ages are invited. They are going to have games and activities, food and refreshments, youth empowerment, prizes, giveaway, Mother's Day tribute. And they just want the whole community to come together. So come on out. It is free. Saturday, May 9th from 12 until 5, community day at the Campostella Shopping Center. And if you are looking for something inspiring to check out this summer, nationally renowned artist Nia Chanel Abney has a remarkable solo exhibition at the New Virginia MoCA on the Virginia Wesleyan campus. And I have seen this exhibition. It is incredible. Her bold, colorful work explores the African-American experience in really thought-provoking ways. The exhibition runs now through August the 16th, but coming up Thursday, May 14th, I See You Bro and Virginia MoCA are hosting an evening inspired by Nina's exhibition, The Pursuit of Happiness. It's a conversation about identity, mental health, joy, and culture, and it's featuring Hampton Boyer and Dathan Kane, plus live music, food, time to explore the galleries. It starts at 6 o'clock in the evening. And you can register at virginiamoca.org. If you have not had a chance to go over to Virginia Wesleyan and check out Virginia MoCA's new location, please take the time to do so. It is absolutely gorgeous, and the artwork is really inspiring. And then finally, Norfolk's Juneteenth celebration, calling itself Celebrating Freedom. They are holding a community forum, and they want to invite the community to come out for a discussion on Juneteenth, and where we will explore history, answer questions, and identify future opportunities together. It's going to be moderated by Dr. Cassandra Newby Alexander and Dr. Claudine Kizert, and there are two opportunities on May 13th at 8:30 in the morning or at 6:30 p.m., or an in-person one on June 2nd at the Attucks Theater at 6:30 p.m. Go to norfolk.gov/Juneteenth in order to register. You know, the very best thing all of us can do as responsible citizens of this country is to educate ourselves on the issues and vote. Please share this show with your circle of influence. Go to whro.org/anotherview to download the podcast. Our theme music is an original composition created especially for Another View by Jay Sennett. Lisa Godley is our show producer. Jordan Christie is our audio engineer, and Dr. Barry Graham answered our phones. I'm Barbara Ham. Lee. Happy Mother's Day to all you moms out there, and let's get together again next Thursday at noon for Another View.
So support comes from Hampton Roads Community Foundation, carrying out your charitable wishes forever. Whether it's helping shelter animals, feeding the homeless, enhancing the arts, or supporting students. Learn more at leaveabequest.org.